Let me just read you a few headlines that I grabbed today. This is May 6th, Bloomberg. Crude oil may rise to between $150 and $200 a barrel within 2 years as growth in supply fails to keep pace with increased demand from developing nations. That was Goldman Sachs Group analyst led by Arjun Murthy in a report. And regarding the possibility that that price rise is due to commodity speculation, they further wrote, "Unfortunately, we do not think the energy crisis will be solved by finding and punishing the big bad speculator." Also, May 6th, Bloomberg. European electricity contracts for next year climbed to records as oil and coal reached an all-time high, increasing production costs for utilities. May 1st, BBC. Oil giant ExxonMobil made $10.9 billion profit in the first 3 months of 2008, up $10.9 billion profit in the first 3 months, up 17% over last year, which was not a bad year for Exxon. 28th of April, BBC. OPEC, the oil-producing cartel, has warned that the price of crude could keep rising to reach $200 a barrel. Okay, so we've got an energy crisis. We've got a climate crisis. We now have a food crisis related to our energy crisis. And we have an economy, an economic, financial, credit crisis related to all of those. Okay? We're, as a matter of fact, today, in getting ready, last week my show was with Kevin Phillips about the credit crisis. And today I chose between my guest, Robert Bryce, on the energy crisis, or Arunata Mittal on the food crisis. And I went today with the energy crisis. We'll have the food crisis in 2 weeks. Times are crazy. We know the price is up. We know supplies seem to be flat. People, depending on your expert, peak oil, which is a point at which we've extracted half of it, which means not that we're out of it, but that the next half is going to be more expensive. In other words, you get the easiest stuff first. So there's peak oil. There's pollution problems. There's health problems. There's climate crisis problems. We're facing a huge dilemma here. And then I get submitted this book, Gusher of Lies, Robert Bryce. And his subtitle is The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Now, I've had Robert on the show before. We talked about James Baker when, the past of James Baker that people too little remember. Based on a book of his called Cronies. He also wrote a book on Enron. He's written for the Texas Observer, which is Molly Ivan's longtime home.
Sure.
And yet this book is at least contrarian. Robert Bryce is the managing editor of Energy Tribune and a contributing writer for the Texas Observer. He's the author of Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron, and Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, America's Superstate. And his newest book, as I said, Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Delusions of Energy Independence. Welcome again, Robert Bryce.
Glad to be here.
Like listeners to get to know a little bit about the people behind the ideas and the work.
Sure.
You, at one point, in something I found through your website, said, "I am a lapsed liberal."
Sure.
And the famous story about liberals is that you're a liberal until you're mugged, right?
Right.
And you said you were a lapsed liberal, and you were a liberal until you were mugged by the laws of thermodynamics.
Correct. Yeah.
Explain.
When it comes to energy, I'm a liberal who got mugged by the laws of thermodynamics. You know, I've been writing about energy on and off for nearly two decades. And some of the earliest stories I published were in national magazine, national newspapers, were on the problems in the oil industry, pollution issues in the oil industry. A lot of those issues still exist. But as I've, especially over the last four, five, 6 years, as I've really drilled down into the energy business, to mix some metaphors here, I realized wind and solar are great. Renewables are, those are promising things for the future. And some of them have applications that are immediate now. I have 3,200 watts of solar panels on the roof of my house in Austin, Texas.
Okay. Not that many listeners can say that.
I believe in solar power. I want it to work. I want it to work better than it does because I've put a lot of money on the roof of my house in the form of the solar panels. But I've also become much more of a realist when it comes to these issues in terms of dealing with and accepting the fact that we're going to be using more wind. We're going to be using more solar. There's no question. And hopefully we can find some biofuels that don't destroy the environment, like ethanol and so on. But algae diesel, for one. But the point is, I've become much more realistic. Yes, all those things are good, but we're not going to quit using fossil fuels for the foreseeable future because it's taken us a century or more to get where we are with oil and coal and natural gas and more recently with nuclear power. We're not going to quit using them anytime soon. And so I wrote this book really as a reality check to say, where are we and what's the way forward?
Well, one thing I noticed was when I went, before I interview an author, I look and see, well, who's been interviewing them?
Sure.
What have other people asked them? What are their replies and so on? And you've been interviewed a lot over the last 2-3 months, obviously. Right. If you're an energy expert and we got an energy crisis, people are going to call on you. But what I noticed was, with few exceptions, it was Reason, it was Cato, it was et cetera, et cetera. Why do you think that primarily right-leaning publications, radio shows, and so on are interviewing you and others are not?
Well, I guess because the book doesn't fit the liberal orthodoxy that only wind and solar are going to get us there. And, I mean, it's been surprising to me. My career in journalism begins from the liberal left, and yet I've come far more to the center, particularly on this issue. I was interviewed by Mother Jones. They have a recent issue on energy, and that was gratifying. E! Magazine just has a new review out by Jim Motovelli saying he likes the book. And I respect Motovelli. He's a smart guy. He's written a lot of really smart stuff on the car business. So it's surprising to me. I mean, you know, I was invited to speak at the American Enterprise Institute and at Cato. I mean, you know, it's what a long, strange trip it's been.
It seems to me when someone says that they've been mugged by something as real, as concrete, as essential as the laws of thermodynamics, that categories like liberal and conservative are kind of not on the same level. In other words, what I'm suggesting is let's throw that stuff out. I'm not interested in political positions or polemics, but you do know the energy biz.
Sure.
You've been in it for a long time. So what I want to do is use you as a resource, which is why I set up this interview to begin with. And the way I'd like to approach it is you at one point say that government, at least you cite cases in which government interference, if you will, government regulation, government mandates, and so on, have failed in the past to have the results that they were predicted to have or hoped to have when it came to energy. So you sort of say, let's have a level playing field and let the market decide. Fair enough?
Absolutely.
Okay, so what I'm interested in then is to go through a lot of the various possibilities in energy.
Sure.
And to level the playing field, it seems to me the first thing we've got to do is we've got to cite the subsidies, and then also the externalities.
Sure.
And by the externalities, you and I both know, that is those things which our regular economic systems are not quite accounting for, like the health costs of oil or coal in their pollution, the risk costs, perhaps, of nuclear, and the climate costs of carbon emissions. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
Let's go first. Oil. What are the subsidies? What are the externalities?
Well, one of the big subsidies here in the U.S., of course, is the depletion allowance. I mean, that's a tax write-off that all the oil drillers here domestically get right off the top in terms of their expenses, what they can count as expense against their production. The most notable one, of course, was in 2005 when they passed the 2005 energy bill and gave huge tax breaks to the oil companies drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, that one I thought was outrageous in that the Gulf of Mexico already is tempting to oil companies all over the world. It's one of the most prolific and most
coveted
oil-bearing regions in the world. Low royalty rates, rule of law applies. Companies are flooding into the Gulf because of the opportunity there. That one, to me, is particularly egregious. And as you say, we don't tax the carbon emissions from oil. Now, what is the right level of carbon emissions or carbon tax, if that's what we're going to have? I don't know. I can't answer that. But yes, oil has a lot of externalities. Virtually every source that we would have has externalities. Milton Friedman had it right. There's no such thing as a free lunch. It's particularly true when it comes to the energy business.
Well, except externalities, by its very definition, almost says somebody is getting a free lunch. In other words, externalities, the definition is, this is something which the oil, the people who own, market, distribute the oil, they make profits, and yet they induce costs on society, locally or globally, that they are not having to pay for. That is, in some sense, it's a free snack. I'll tell you.
Right. Yeah, they're not getting lunch for free, but they're not paying the full.
Right. Picking up part of their their lunch.
Fair enough.
Okay. So oil depletion allowances. Anything else?
Because those are the big ones. The depletion allowances.
How much is that?
You know, I don't know. I write about it in Cronies because this has been an issue since really the 1920s in terms of the tax break. And so, but I haven't seen any quantification of that recently. But that's only a domestic issue, you understand?
Right. Before we leave oil, given the enormous profits, the high price per barrel of crude, the high price per gallon of gasoline, and the enormous profits, would you see anything being done right now to sort of deal with that set of elements? In other words, one would be remove some of the subsidies that have been given them and do it now. Others would say windfall profits tax, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, look, I mean, if we increase the taxes on the oil companies, what are they going to do? They're going to increase the price. I mean, this is nuts. The idea that, one, now Hillary is saying, oh, a gas tax holiday.
That was going to be my next question.
It's silly.
Silly if you're trying to appeal to voters.
It's silly if
you're trying to do anything about the problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's silly. It's only silly if you don't want to pander. But anyway, I mean, I just edited a story for Energy Tribune, our correspondent in Beijing. Oil demand in China in the first quarter grew 16.5%. I mean, what we are seeing now, we can talk.
That's amazing.
Oh, it's phenomenal. The amount, and part of it, he points out, our correspondent there, saying part of that is due to the subsidies on the price controls on motor fuel in China. So what we're having globally is perverted markets with too much government intervention. And the subsidies here in the U.S., the subsidies for ethanol. I mean, we're driving up the price of
food. We'll get to ethanol.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me also say one other thing, which I meant to say at the top, which is that when I first pick up the book and it says Dangerous Delusion of Energy Independence, I go right on, because I also believe that calls for energy independence are either pandering, delusion, or give them the benefit of the doubt, really a lack of precision.
Hillary said it last night she interviewed with Katie Couric and said, oh, we need energy independence. It's moronic.
Right.
This is cheap political rhetoric. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is I'm tired of being lied to.
Right. Now, and where you and I agree, and it looked, when I looked at that Mother Jones issue, it looked like McKibben agreed, looked like some other, Paul Roberts.
Yeah.
Who used to talk about energy independence, he agreed. And the reason is that our energy situation in the world is globally interdependent.
Exactly.
And no one can achieve independence. Iran imports oil.
Right. They import gasoline. They import.
Exactly.
They're a net natural gas importer.
Right.
Let me just give a couple of quick facts.
Okay.
In 2007, the U.S. imported oil or oil products from 90 different countries. We exported on average of 1.4 million barrels a day of oil and oil products to customers in 73 countries. It's an interdependent world.
Right. So independence is a slogan.
It's a joke.
Yeah. So what we want then, it seems to me, and I'm just setting this up again sort of as a premise up top, is we want to accept that reality of the interdependence.
Absolutely.
And then, no, what I've often said is what the U.S., if the U.S. wanted a Manhattan Project, an Apollo Project about energy, it would not be energy independence. It would be coming up with the methods and the technologies and so on to solve the global energy crisis, not our own.
Exactly. And that's one of the points where I talk about at the end of the book. We have to accept this interdependence, particularly if we're going to try and deal with this issue of CO2 and carbon dioxide. It has to be a global solution. Everyone's saying, well, the U.S. has to do something. Absolutely. But if China's coal consumption or coal production in the first quarter went up 14.5%. I mean, they are producing enormous amounts of coal. We can't say, oh, we're going to solve it here and let the Chinese do whatever.
Now, the Chinese have stated that energy efficiency is their number one strategy,
development. And they're moving that way.
And they're moving in that direction. So while, as we see, oil up, coal up, coal plants still being built and so on. Their plan is, you know, those are the manifestation of things that were probably put in place 3, 4, 5 years ago. But their plan is, aren't their CAFE standards tougher than ours?
Well, they are.
And CAFE standards are the mileage you need to get per gallon.
Yeah, they are. China has stricter fuel efficiency standards than the U.S., and they, if I'm not mistaken, they actually have a tax on the larger engine that you have, the more expensive the vehicle.
Yeah.
So they've adjusted their market in that way. So, look, I mean, you know, you're talking about externalities. Everything has an externality. One of the points that I make in the book, and one of the things that makes me optimistic about the future, and one area that I think is so overlooked in the U.S., we talk about all these different fuels. Why is it there a discussion of more use of natural gas in the U.S.? Now, here's a fuel that, compared to coal, emits half as much CO2. It emits, in a natural gas vehicle, emits 15% less CO2 per mile or whatever than a gasoline vehicle, and 15% less than a diesel vehicle and 20% less than a gasoline vehicle. We're stuck on ethanol. We're stuck on all this other nonsense. Why isn't there a discussion of natural gas vehicles, for one?
Well, we know why we're stuck on ethanol, which is that the same large agribusiness companies who have lots of legislators in their pockets. And the Farm Bill, folks, we've done several shows on it. The Farm Bill has not passed yet. If you want to make a difference in terms of food crisis, in terms of food stamps, in terms of organic farming, in terms of ethanol, get involved in the Farm Bill. Because they only go every 5 years, and if this one passes as it currently stands, it is just prolonging a terrible, terrible situation. So ethanol was the baby of a bunch of lobbyists and a bunch of legislators in their pockets.
Sure.
Why isn't there more talk of natural gas? I know that L.A. has an awful lot of buses running on natural gas.
You know, I wish I understood this better, and I don't understand it. There are a couple of interesting things that are at play here. In the United States, gas consumption, natural gas consumption, has been flat really since 1996. Gas consumption has been flatter than a tabletop. At the same time, domestic gas exploration production has had remarkable success in coal bed methane and tight gas and shale gas. All these companies are exploring their huge new gas discoveries in the continental U.S. We have huge gas fields in Alaska that still haven't been tapped. There's an enormous domestic resource. We import 20% of our natural gas. We import 60% of our oil. Why aren't I? Here's my hunch on this, Terrence.
Okay, because I was going to say, I mean, you're studying this as much as anybody.
Here's my hunch on this is that for the green left, natural gas means big oil, and big oil is bad. Therefore, we don't want natural gas. That's my now. Whether that's
but wait. That would give the green side way too much power. They're not stopping.
I don't know. The Sierra Club, there was a story that was published a few months ago that said the Sierra Club was pro-natural gas. An industry magazine came up with a story. The Sierra Club said, no, we're not. We're not.
I mean,
I'm just like, well, wait a minute.
They don't determine policy on natural gas.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But there's no stroke in Congress for the natural gas vehicle. Let me just mention quickly, Brazil. Brazil, everybody talks about ethanol in Brazil.
Right.
Okay, fine. The U.S. produces more ethanol than Brazil, blah, blah, blah. Brazil's Petrobras, the national oil company in Brazil, is the reason Brazil is doing so well in terms of energy. But Brazil has 10 times as many one-tenth as many motor vehicles as the U.S. They have 10 times as many natural gas vehicles.
Yeah. As you point out, if we used as much gas per citizen as Brazil does, we'd look like a shining example of independence as well.
Right, yeah. But we'd only drive one day a week.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's talk then briefly about natural gas.
Sure.
Subsidies, externalities, and benefits.
Well, the externalities first. You know, it emits CO2, but it's less than practically any other fuel. Any other fuel, it's cleanest of the hydrocarbons. The externalities, they get subsidies, tax subsidies in terms of the drilling side, just as the oil companies do. I think those are the main ones.
Okay, coal, subsidies, externalities. Benefits.
The subsidies, as I looked at a study that was done by the Department of Energy in terms of overall subsidies to the coal industry, and as I recall, they are among the lowest of any of the fossil fuel industries. But of course, there are big externalities: the coal dust, the coal trains, the coal, you know, the mercury in the air, sulfur dioxide, carbon dioxide. All those are big externalities.
Yeah, the world would be better off if we could get along without a new coal plant.
Well, yes, I mean that would be ideal, but we get 50% of our electricity. So if
Still,
we quit using coal, then turn off the lights half the day.
Okay. oil, coal, nuclear subsidies. And in that one, the one that I want to mention, because sometimes people don't mention it, is, if I'm not mistaken, nuclear plants cannot get even dreamed about unless the taxpayers are willing to underwrite the insurance of them.
Sure.
That the risk is too great for any private investor to take them on.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know whether the private insurers, there's no market maker in that, so I don't know how you would go to Lloyd's of London and say, how to, you know, cover me for Chernobyl or whatever, or Three Mile Island. So yes, the taxpayers are underwriting that insurance, just as a similar program would be Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. We're essentially underwriting the insurance for myriad home loan mortgages, but that's a little different. But
and let's hope the other one doesn't work out as poorly as that one did.
Well, right, and we're giving more risk to Fannie and Freddie, but
exactly.
that's a whole different discussion. The externalities, of course, the waste material. You know, what do we do with it? That's an issue. The risk of catastrophic meltdown or whatever. That's a risk. But it's also, I come out in the book, the first article I ever published was in high school, it was anti-nuclear. If I was the editor of my high school newspaper. Today, 30 years later, I'm saying, well, if we think CO2 is bad, as I see it, nuclear is the only source that it can provide relatively large amounts of electricity in a relatively short time at a relatively agreeable cost. And the key issue there is, the key word is relatively.
I saw a debate between Stuart Brand, founder of the Whole Earth Catalog, who now is
pro-nuclear,
and Peter Warshall, one of his partners at the Global Business Network, who is not. And Brand made his case, basically, we need it, and it's better than coal, which is basically what he said. If we're going to make some of our energy right now from either coal or nuclear, we'd be better off in nuclear. Warshall said it's going to take you at least 10 years to get a new plant opened. So it's not going to be an immediate help to anything, and I think that's important to realize. He then said, however, if we started at the start of those 10 years, instead of trying to build nuclear plants, going to the decentralized distribution of electricity, using everyone's solar panels, everyone's hybrid plug-in and so on, to actually generate energy back to the system when at night and so on, that a decentralized energy distribution system in this country would mean we wouldn't need the advantages, the alleged advantages of coal or nuclear. What do you say?
Well, I've heard those arguments before. I mean, this is what Amory Lovins has been putting forward for decades. I understand the.
Although he's not that much older than you are. Go ahead.
Okay, but the point there is that yes, that the decentralized grid would be fine, but smaller power plants are inherently more costly than larger ones, and that's true for gas. It's true for coal. It's true for nuclear. It's true across the board. The issue is always about energy density, cost, and scale. And that is what – we don't use oil and coal and these other fuels because we're bad. We use them because they have the energy density that we crave. They give us the kind of energy that we need to apply for making natural – for making lights, for making lasers, for making whatever. Cost and scale are the other ones, and cost and scale are directly related to the issue of energy density. I just came across the thing this morning. I'll give you a quick fact. There's a book coming out. It's called A Cubic Mile of Oil. And if you envision a cubic mile of oil, that's about what global production of oil equals about one cubic mile.
Wait, global production in a day?
In a year. I'm sorry, forgive me. A year of oil production in the world is about equals about one cubic mile. To equal that amount, one cubic mile of oil per year, here's the quote, we'd need to equip 250,000 roofs a day with solar panels for the next 50 years to have enough photovoltaic infrastructure to provide the world with a cubic miles of oil worth of solar-generated electricity for a year. It gives you an idea of the scale.
Now, wait, you said
250,000 roofs
a day
per day
for 50 years to get the amount of energy in 1 year's current extraction and refinement of oil.
Correct.
Wow.
I mean, that's a mind-blowing number.
So I'm going to give you – I got to be off at 28 and a half. I'm going to give you 1 minute to sort of sum up what do we do?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I think we really need to be looking at is batteries. And batteries, I have a thing in the book about the super battery prize. Let's offer $1 billion to anyone who can come up with a super battery that is compact, affordable, and safe, that can store multiple kilowatt hours of electricity. Let's offer $10 billion to anyone who can come up with a battery with similar properties that can store multiple megawatt hours. That's one. I think second, let's look at batteries. Let's try and develop batteries. Second, just briefly, I went by Tesla Motors last night on Santa Monica. I saw the car in the window. I realized it has 7,000 lithium-ion batteries in it. 7,000. It has the energy equivalent in those 7,000 batteries of 2 gallons of gasoline. I mean, it's remarkable. So batteries are one. We need to embrace natural gas. I think we have to be serious about nuclear, but more than any of those, we have to be serious about interdependence. Accept our interdependence in global CO2 and banking and people and the flow of people, goods and ideas. We are an independent world.
Okay, and the thing that I will say is that we have to change our lifestyle, our use of land, our use of transportation and so on, so that we're actually taking these issues seriously and adapt the way we need and use energy. Again, the book is Gusher of Lies, The Dangerous Solutions of Energy Independence. The website is robertbrice.com. Thank you, Robert Bryce.
Thanks a million.